This is Calliope Writing Coach, the podcast about writing and publishing success from every angle. I'm Angie Fenimore, international best-selling author and writing coach.
And I'm Michael Sheen, author, platform designer, and marketing master. Episode 26, What's Tie-Dye Got to Do with It? Welcome, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Calliope Writing Coach Podcast. Mike and Angie are in the house.
Hey. I know. I don't ever know what to say when you say that.
Just say, hey, hey.
Hey, hey. Hey, hey.
Welcome, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Calliope Writing Coach Podcast. We've got Michael Sheen here and...
Angie. What the heck? I liked the other one. Hey, hey. I like that.
You like the hey, hey.
I do.
I always say that, though, so I was trying to say something different.
Trying to say something different? Yeah. But it's funny if I say hey, hey, so say it. Just do it this time, and then you got to change it up.
Okay, Welcome, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Calliope Writing Coach Podcast. We've got Michael and Angie in the house.
Hey, hey.
And we've got... Without a doubt, the most colorful character.
No joke.
In the writing community here, Johnny Worthen. Welcome, Johnny.
Hello. Woo-hoo.
Johnny says, I write what I like to read. That guarantees me at least one fan. Johnny Worthen is an award-winning, best-selling author, voyager, and damn fine human being. He is the tie-dyed wearing writer of the nationally acclaimed number one Kindle best-selling Eleanor, the Unseen. Among his other excellent and very read-worthy titles are the adult occult thriller Beatricelle, the award-winning mystery The Brand Demand, and the genre-bending comedy noir The Finger Trap. Winner of the Diamond Quill for the Best Book of the Year, and of course, the continuation of the Unseen trilogy with Celeste and David, which have also won awards. Trained in stand-up comedy, modern literary criticism, and cultural studies, Johnny is a frequent public speaker, teacher, and a blogger. He's an instructor at the University of Utah and an acquisitions editor for the Omnium Gatherum, a publisher of unique dark fantasy, weird fiction, and horror. Johnny, welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having me. It's a long bio, I know.
It's a mouthful for sure.
You should do the longer one where I get to talk about all my short stories and the suicide notes I've written and the graffiti I put down on that I-70 restroom, which is still there, by the way. I'm telling you, Sharpies have nothing on chisels.
No. You can't even paint over them.
No.
And unless you do it with kills, it bleeds right back through, you know?
Yeah, and hopefully when people read that, they're just taken back. And I think they've sent people in there to spackle it over or something, but they read it and they're so touched, they just leave it. So, you know, for like 6 years now, that graffiti has remained. I can't tell you what it is. Just drive I-70, preferably alone in the dark. And when you really need to pee from the coffee, you'll know.
That's where it is. That's where it is.
And you'll see it.
So stand-up comedian, like this makes sense to me. And I've seen your bio, like, dozens of times probably, and I don't know why, like, you know how it is, you just don't see, your eyes stop seeing things. Oh, yeah. And they fill in words and they take out words, and you know
why we can't edit our own stuff after a while.
It's like I'm exactly. Having this complete like ding 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 ding, oh of course, epiphany right now
because of the stand-up comedy
thing. Yeah, it's like, well, oh yeah, of course you would be.
Well, it's all related. It's stand-up comedy is honestly just a way for you to control how other people laugh at you. Mm-hmm. Knowing they're going to laugh at you, so it's mm-hmm. controlling the situation, which is, it's kind of controlling how the world perceives you. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of what being a writer is about, trying to get, well, maybe that's not exactly a good segue, but it's but there's still, we're sensitive, broken people as a whole, writers, and so mm-hmm. I use stand-up and theater in order to build that wall,
right,
to give me that distance.
It was John Cleese that said that all comedy is offensive.
Yes. That sounds like the kind of thing that jerk would say. What an ass. I love John. I was talking to John the other day, and he's
hanging out at Starbucks.
Not really. I studied theater and stand-up comedy because I think I saw a great quote that you can judge somebody's intelligence by what they laugh at.
I say that a lot because, you know, I think we are all highly intelligent people in our house. So. And we're always laughing. And the kids are just like ridiculous IQs through the roof, like right up there with the Unabomber. And it's
thanks for bringing that back home. That's good.
Yeah, really.
That brings it right around.
But it's like always, we are always laughing.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
But it's the same kind of thing. You see, what you're doing here with the podcast is kind of sacrilegious if you think about it. I mean, the idea of a writer is generally somebody who's either introverted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or broken.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, if they're extroverted like I am, though I'm really not, this is all an act.
No, but, I get that. No, you know, I get that. Yeah, I'm an ambivert.
Ambivert is what the new term is.
I have come to. Recently, I have a private client. Shout out to Amy Clancy. She's going to love that.
I'm writing this down.
So she was saying, you know what? I think we're the same personality, except for you're the outgoing one and I'm the introvert. And so we actually, I took personality tests, not like I've never done that before, because like I studied psychology.
Part of your release?
Just for fun. And we were exactly I don't even know what the name of it is, but Stanford, Binet, maybe. I don't know which one it was. Anyway, I determined I'm an ambivert, which makes a whole lot more sense.
So what's the definition of an ambivert?
An ambivert is like sometimes you're outgoing and sometimes you want to crawl into your hole. And like, I hate having a microphone in my face. I have to talk myself down from the ledge every podcast, every time I speak. And for about the first minute, the audience is like looking at me like, wow, you're awfully uncomfortable, aren't you? And then I'm just in the role. Plus, I'm leading conferences. Like, well, I'm in front of large groups all the time, right?
It's, yeah, I totally get that. I'm the same way. I studied, you know, when I teach authors and talking about public events, speaking, because, you know, I believe you have to give back, right? If you're a writer and you're taking anything out of the community, you damn well better put it back and then some with interest. It's just good karma, not, let alone being good manners. But nevertheless, people, generally writers, I mean, a lot of people might approach this, oh, this is a way to make money quick, and good luck to
you. Oh, no. Yeah.
But the idea of actually putting yourself out there, the only way to really successfully do this is to recognize the fact that we fall into a different character depending on what situations we're in. And if you can consciously slide yourself into that writing persona or that teaching persona or that other persona you need to be, you know, at the right moment, it gives you, again, I'll say, a certain level of insulation.
And I would say the operative word there is consciously.
If you can do it right.
Like, I absolutely do that. That is what I do. It's like, okay, it's showtime.
Yeah, it's the way to do it. I mean, it's tricky, and some days I just don't feel it. Particularly, I'm at my best when I'm most stressed. I'm at my best when I'm most nervous. So when I go to conferences outside of the state, no one knows me, and I can redefine myself, and I have nothing. I don't have the previous years of experience with these people, which is both freeing and containing at the same time. Mm-hmm. I find myself just exploding. I'm a great person. Those moments, like when I first meet somebody's family, they love me, and then by the fifth or sixth time I get to know them, and I don't care, I just gonna sit in a corner and write. I don't care what you think of me anymore, you have your opinion, I'm off.
Yeah
So I don't know. The whole idea of being a public figure as a writer, it's something that we don't really think about much. I mean, there are a lot of events where there are mixes of authors, director, I mean, for example, in the cinema, actors always get all the publicity, right? And yet they're really not really the major driving force behind any creative act. Right?
No, definitely.
Lately, it's been the special effect director who's probably most worthy of it. Mm-hmm. I see so many movies now that just turn my stomach and I weep. But but writers, nevertheless, I mean, they used to be much more public figures. I remember watching the Dick Cavett Show. You know, now I'm dating myself. I was very young.
Well, yeah. I'll date myself too. I know the Dick Cavett Show. Michael doesn't. I'll bet Michael doesn't know. Do you know who Dick Cavett is?
You know, I can't say I watched anything that wasn't available on Nick at Night.
Yeah.
So if they played it on Nick at Night, then I'm aware.
Never. But what about The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson?
Okay, yeah, I'm there with that one.
Authors on there. Right now I think there's probably like four authors in the world that have any kind of global recognition. That I can name them. It's
J.K. Rowling.
George Martin. Stephen King.
Yeah.
Stephen King for sure.
And that's probably where we stop. And maybe for a while.
Stephanie
Meyer, you think so? Yeah. I don't think I'd know
maybe
her on the
not.
Street.
I wouldn't. Yeah.
Yeah.
And yet, I guess, and I think every person who had the misfortune of being in Skull Island will be recognized.
I know the other one. It's Elizabeth Gilbert.
Nope.
You don't know who Elizabeth? You wouldn't recognize Elizabeth Gilbert?
No, but
really?
But I would recognize.
But she did the TED Talk, that all about, you know, the creative genius.
All right. Well, that's if we're going to start talking TED Talk, we had Tim.
I think the TED stage has definitely brought the author back into the forefront.
Possibly, but let's face it, that's not mass.
I wouldn't say so. No, I wish
it were, but it's not. But what I'm saying is, so. But nevertheless, you have to coming around to this. You still have to have the idea that you are still a public figure.
You sure do, because you will be recognized.
Readers
and often at will the find you. You know the times you least want to be recognized.
There is that. You know, it's like I wear tie dye. I make no sense of it, but I don't try to go out and scream.
Yeah.
But it's still-
So yeah, while we're on the subject of it, I do want to talk about your branding, because anytime that we talk about branding, it is, you know, you want to develop your own brand. And you know, definitely in the local community, we say like Johnny Worthen, you know,
Totally.
I think like that you have definitely defined, sorry, I'd cut you off.
You sure did.
I've been doing it all night.
For some reason, this is like meshing though.
And then, sorry.
I know I'm like sitting over here on the sideline for once.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Branding.
Let's talk about branding for a little bit.
And I didn't mean to. What happened is I got into writing from first of all, my background is not what your traditional one, but I had a lot of different careers, a lot of different jobs. My character, Tony Flanner, is very much me, where he's bounced off career after career after career. I know people went to college and they're doing the same job they did when they were in college. You know, we're 50 years old now. And so, they've had one career. Mm-hmm. I've had a lot. And I don't say jobs, I say career, because each and every one of them could have kept going for a long time. But I realized that I really hated everything. My resume reads like a list of things I don't want to do anymore. I won't do anymore. Mm-hmm. Here, so show me your resume. This is a list of shit I'll never do again, no matter what. So I realized that I came to a point in my life. I'd started a business. I'd bought a business. I've run my own business. I've run other people's businesses. I haven't had a boss in 15, 20 years. So if I wanted to get a real job, there's nobody alive you can call, right? But anyway... And then this one kind of fell through, my last little job. And I realized, you know, I had that bucket list moment, that Shawshank Redemption moment, get busy living or get busy dying. I realized I'm not living my life the way I want to. Mm-hmm. And I'm sick of wearing suits because suits suck. I'm most comfortable in shorts and tie-dye because they're just cool. Mm-hmm. And when I started defining, and you mentioned earlier, my quote is, I write what I like to read. That guarantees me one fan, which is kind of what it is. It was a selfish act. Mm-hmm. To become a writer, because I just felt the overwhelming need to do it. It's the only thing in my life I've consistently always wanted to do and haven't done.
Well, you're really good at it too,
well,
though.
Thank you. Yeah. I, Lord knows I'm trying. But it's but the branding came about when I realized no one was there to tell me how to do it. Mm. And they say that you will, given the choice, you will dress as you dressed at the happiest time in your life. Apparently, I really liked The Grateful Dead. Just saying. So, shorts and a t-shirt and tie dye. And tie dye to me is everything that I want. It's not just colorful, which is nice, because you don't wear tie dye for yourself. You wear it for other people. This was told to me at a Grateful Dead show. Mm-hmm. You don't see it. You're looking over it, but all these tripping eyes around you, they're loving your shirt, Joe. So that's why you do it. You do it for other people. And on top of that, true to the tie-dye I wear, it's never mass-produced. I know these artists. I communicate with them. Mm. And this is a work of art. So they have put something in there. And this will wear out. And this will fall off my shirt. This will have holes and I will retire it. And that is the way of life. A beautiful work of art, even something like a shirt that can last for years, mm-hmm. is still a transient thing. Yeah, so it's a symbol.
A meal that lasts 3 hours.
A song that lasts 2 minutes, a dance, a moment. All these transient issues, which has kind of become an echo and a theme of my writing, because I realize, but the idea is I'm wearing this because I want to. And I remember when I had one of my first launches, I think it was for Eleanor, Jollyfish said, okay, dress nice. And I said, I'm coming in tie-dye. And they argued with me, and I said, I'm coming in tie-dye. Mm-hmm. They've never asked me to come in a suit again.
Well, it'd be really weird for Lady Gaga to show up at the Tonight Show without, like, those cheek implants.
Oh, she's got
to
have something.
And actually, she was trying to break in and was getting nowhere. And that was when she invented the persona. And please note, now that she's at the top, she's now speaking her message. You know
exactly.
what I mean? Because now she's got a worldwide audience because she put on some cheek implants and, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, to me, the tie-dye fits just, it is actually a pretty good reflection. I don't think it is a brand. I honestly, if I weren't doing this and I could wear tie-dye, I would wear tie-dye. It makes, I'm a lazy man. It makes choosing clothes in the morning really easy. The question is which one to pull out. I got some new ones just the other day.
Yeah, I would wear a pink robe and pajamas.
See, that works out fine. But, you know, the whole idea, We see, I mean, all this stuff I wear, and I wear it. I don't necessarily talk about it on social media, but I wear it. I mean, I have certain, I have very strong political views. I have very strong philosophical views. I write, I mean, I'm a studied occultist. I'm a Freemason. I have a humanities degree. I'm a screaming liberal, people. What can I say? but, you know, I kind of, and my thinking usually comes through in my books. My most political book is The Brand Demand. And that came from a very angry time in my life. And it required the most editing of all my books. It was probably the first thing I wrote. But it finally came out to a good point. When I realized, when I took the political and turned it personal, then it actually became
It alters true. Everything.
It does. And, and the whole idea is that the character, his name is Galen Reed. This book I could not get published in the state of Utah, by the way. At the time, my publisher said, we're not ready for this yet. But I got it published in Virginia. And it won an award in Utah. So what do I know?
Who knows? Who knows?
Yeah. Well, I call that walking the dog, where, you know, the dog is out in front, right? Arriving before you do everywhere. But you've got the leash. You're back here. You want your reader to be out in front and actually come to the conclusions. So you're not feeding.
Oh, right.
And so that's how you do it. You just put them in the skin. Make sure your readers are in the skin of those characters. And then you provide proper motivation and you can do anything.
Well, it's a telepathy. Writing is a true magic. It's unlike all of the narrative media. Writing gets into a person's head. Where you watch a movie and you're getting a visual impact. I mean, it's very visual. Mm-hmm. It's everybody experiences the event in the same amount of time. Mm-hmm. Everybody sees the same things in the same order. And you will do, since it's still since we're still symbolic creatures, we will interpret it as we will. But it's very much set. Radio a little bit more. It creates you. If you're just hearing something, if you're hearing noise, you know, like a noise. If you're hearing a radio program, this podcast, for example, or a play, which is mostly spoken. There is some visual, but mostly it's an auditory medium. You as a listener come a little further, and the writer gets a little deeper in your head.
Right.
But the canvas of a book is within the reader's mind.
Yes.
And so, exactly.
And where you can see what a character does in a movie, you can hear what a character says in a play, and you can probably do both of them. But in a book, you are privy to their thoughts. Mm-hmm. And unless you get a soliloquy or something, which is totally unrealistic, you'll never get within a thought. But writing, by definition, gets into the character's thinking. And it's why it's still around.
It's completely interactive with the reader too. With something that you see visually, it's all there before you, and your brain is actually not interacting with that medium quite like it would with an audio.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's like our listeners probably can see you right now in shorts and tie dye, but they don't know whether or not I'm in a pink robe or.
They will when I post to Instagram.
I know, there we go. Right?
So why writing? When did you develop this propensity to write?
I'm not sure. I wrote my first story. I have a memory of in sixth grade of writing a story about a werewolf and just on a whim. And the teacher tried to read it to the class and couldn't because my handwriting was so bad. And this has begun a theme in my life. My handwriting was so bad. But I've always written. I've always communicated. It's always been part of me. I'm not as well-read as a lot of people I know, and I'm much better read than most people I know. Mm-hmm. I got into college and didn't know what I wanted to be. I had this problem. In high school, I remember very specifically, they said, okay, so what do you want to be? We're going to tell us what you want to be, and we'll put together classes for you. All right, so, you want to be an engineer? We'll give you all these math classes. Mm-hmm. You want to be this, you want to do that. I had no answer. I flat out did not know. I had a friend who said, I want to be a computer programmer. Guess what he's doing now? He's a computer programmer. But I was, I never knew. My friend said, well, you just want to be a jack of all trades. No, not really. I just didn't know what I wanted to do. It took me forever. I went to college. I got a good scholarship. Grades have always been solid. And I went through all of my general eds, everything. And, you know, you're only supposed to take general eds in a discipline you're not going to study.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to be an engineer, you don't take the math classes. You're going to get those anyway.
Right.
I took everything until they finally said, you can't take any more classes that'll help you unless you know where you're going. Choose a damn major. So, you know, and I realized the only classes, the ones I enjoyed the most were the humanities. And I really enjoyed the writing classes. And I really enjoyed, not necessarily the criticism classes. I liked understanding the meaning of this art. So I took a major in English lit criticism with a minor in classics. It means I speak Latin. Yes,
Do you really?
Latin, yes. Say something. I have a minor in Latin.
Say something in Latin.
Let me rephrase that. I read Latin.
It's Latin.
A dead language. Don vita espes. You know, I studied Latin as my foreign language, and so totally worthless degrees. In all honesty, if you're in college for a job, if you're there for wisdom, I can't imagine a better course than what I took. I was reading Catullus in the original. I read the Aeneid in the original. I read the Vulgate, the New Testament in Latin, and it was mind-boggling. Nevertheless, so then those were the classes. You see what was happening here is I'm not actually writing it. I took a couple of creative writing classes, and I did not like them because I do not write well with others. then I decided I loved academia. I love what I'm doing. I went on for a master's degree, and I studied. At this point, I become such a solid literary critic, and I know all the I know deconstruction. I speak Lacan, semiotics. Mm-hmm. I know all this stuff. I'm really good at it. I love it. I can't watch a commercial on television without deconstructing it. I was in love with it.
Oh, and
I
that's realized, me.
Yeah.
People don't like to watch with me now.
It's usually. I mean, that's why I walked out of movies anyway. But then I moved into my graduate work, and I realized I was very interested in the cultural criticism more than literary, because the problem is, though, books do portray a very good snapshot of a culture at any given time. The problem with books, and this is, I know, we are, as writers, we are candle makers in the age of the LED. Mm-hmm. The culture is not being carried in books anymore. I'm sorry. I wish it were, but it's not. The culture is really being reflected and driven right now by more visual medium, which means film. Mm-hmm. And when I was in college, film was definitely far and away the most, and television too, the visual medium, what people are watching and doing. Mm-hmm. And so I took a film major. I ended with a graduate master's degree in American studies, film emphasis, which sounds far from English. But you can see, again, my writing is very academic. I wrote a 50-page thesis on, my thesis was on Blade Runner.
Oh, really?
Which I suggested that Deckard was a replicant. This is before it was known that Deckard was a replicant. But I was way ahead of my time. I was that damn smart. People said, oh, you'll never get this away. But I did. And then later, only many years, and I kept writing, just kept writing because I love writing. Only at that critical moment when I had this moment in my life when I could choose something else, and I said, it's time to start living, time to start doing this. I put together a war chest to survive a few years.
And how old were you then? Like, how long ago was this?
45.
Okay.
5 years ago.
Okay, cool.
I'm 5 years into my 10-year plan to be an overnight success. And that's when I started writing for fiction. But you see, the problem with my writing is, if you look at, I'm a multi-genre author, right? I debuted in horror. I called it a love story. I thought I was writing a love story. No, what the hell did I know? It's a horror. It's about the dark side of love. Beatrice L, my debut. And then my bestseller is a young adult character study, which has got some paranormal into it. So there's a theme there, but not quite. Then the book that I wrote, Eleanor, so I could blackmail my publisher into taking the book I really wanted published, which is The Finger Trap, which won the Diamond Quill this year for the best book in the state. But I blackmailed them, and they're all very different books. So what is it? See, and as a multi-genre author, I'm very tricky to place. I'm represented now by Terry Baranowski.
With
Gateway Literary, and she has a work cut out for me because, unlike a painter, I'm not supposed to change genres. You know, Van Gogh always paint. You know, if Van Gogh paints a style, but he's most famous perhaps for his landscape, Starry Night. But then he went and wrote a portrait. That sounds stupid that he's not allowed to do a portrait after a famous landscape.
Right,
but that's kind of
right.
How it is for a writer.
Right.
You're not allowed to jump around. But to turn this back, what I was getting to, all my books are basically linked together from the inside out. I do not write a story because a story comes to me. I write from the theme first. Mm-hmm. I deliberately put in those pieces and that understructure that I so fell in love with as a critic. Now, not every writer, many great writers don't understand that they're actually writing to theme. Or that all these different disparate pieces that they just throw out there because their mind took them there
can actually
be taken together and used to build a complex thematic web of meaning beyond what they thought they were. Whenever an author tells you what their book is about, take that with a grain of salt. They really might not even know. Mm-hmm. The subconscious works with it. Now, when I write a book, I very consciously, I'm trying to address a problem, a question. In Beatrice L, it was the dark side of love. I saw friends of mine fall apart in a wave of divorce. This happened when we were in Oregon, and we were far from home. And I swear to God, it was like a plague. Mm-hmm. You'd watch one couple die, one couple get in trouble, would spread to this couple, spread to this couple. They'd come talking to my wife. Try to get her involved in it, which would then
the drama.
Yeah, we grabbed each other and hit each other. I hid in the basement for 8 months. When he came back, it was a scorched earth. But this is what I try to work through in Beatrice.
So what's the theme then?
The theme is the dark side of love.
Okay, and then what's the overarching theme?
Well, there's no moral to it. Oh, there's none. It's just whatever's happening at the time. Okay. In The Finger Trap, it is a very autobiographical story. And there I'm basically exploring my own life and what I've done, so many things that I've never pushed through to the end. And I love mystery because mystery is a great pattern upon which you can cut any cloth. Mm-hmm. And I use that. And while he's solving this mystery of who killed this girl, because he's involved in it, he's actually growing up and very much to me. And it has a lot of thematic elements. The Finger Trap itself is a very heavy symbolic piece to it. His own life. It's mostly comedy. It's the lightest thing I've written, but it's still, I came from that concept is every chapter. I before I start a book, I'll always know what my ideas are I'm trying to work with. And I'll make a list of overall theme. And then my question, you know, the only difference I have between George Martin, really, I can't believe I said that, but no, George, you're awesome. I get to meet him. But he's, his story doesn't, he writes by the seat of his pants, and I'm plotting this thing. Yeah. So
let's distinguish what's a pantser, what's a plotter.
But the idea is a pantser is somebody who basically writes by the seat of their pants. They sit down and they write whatever when the muse strikes them, and the words just come out and the book just flows out of this. The two of the most famous authors in American literature today are famously pantsers, and that would be George Martin, George R.R. Martin, and Stephen King, famously pantsers. Mm-hmm. And this is, sorry, George, this is why your books aren't done yet. Sorry.
Exactly. And then, I'm a pantser too, but
good help.
I always plot first.
That doesn't count.
Yeah.
No. It does. Because,
it does not.
Yes, because it's a conscious thing. Just like when I speak, I do not want to be on that stage with a microphone in my face. Like, I don't want to do that. And yet I have a commitment. So the commitment will drive. So I will plot out at least the beginning and kind of like what the ending is going to look like, whether
that counts,
you know, and then I'll write the try-fail cycles. I'll just write the try-fail cycles and then I go around. Yeah. And then I can, then I'm not spending a lot of time.
See, you can't call yourself a pantser.
A pantser. It's pantser. It's totally pantsy. Yeah.
You know where you're going.
No, you don't know where you're going.
Yeah, see, when Stephen King starts his novel, he doesn't know how it ends. Writes.
Yeah, do you think for a second that Stephen King imagined The Stand standing in Vegas when he started Captain Trips in the first...
Yeah, it's just being unorganized. Like, I'm a total pantser, and then I organize. Intention.
No. It's like I'm a vegan, but I love meat, and I eat it all the time.
Okay, well, that would be true, too.
You can't call yourself a pantser.
Yeah, she's a part-time vegetarian.
That's what I call myself, part-time vegetarian.
I'm a vegan, but mostly I eat beef. No, you can't do it. I'm sorry, Angie. If you don't know, the difference is a pantser writes by the seat of your pants. A plotter, by means, is a plot. You've written something down. You have some sort of structure or at least an ending in mind. And that is often enough. For a short story, I just have an ending in mind and I got to get there. But for novels, I generally have the ending in mind. And you can write to that. And then I have a couple more scenes. And then sometimes I have scenes between scenes. And before you know it, I've got a plot. I've got an outline you.
What I'm saying is I do it on purpose because my natural inclination is to be a pantser.
Oh, we all do. But the problem is those books never get finished. And that's,
I know.
And that, that
tell
is,
me about
I
never, it.
I tell my students all the time, don't do that.
Yeah.
So don't do that. But it's, you know, it's
agreed. Unless you have no intention of being published, and that's fine.
Well, we all write for different reasons. I mean, I try not to chase the market, but I am aware of where my books will fit and do any different things. And I wish that I could be satisfied with writing the same genre. I mean, I admit that if when Terry places one of my books and they say we want 6 more in this series, I will probably end up writing those before I get back to some other genre.
Yeah, we'll bring you on in a couple of years and we'll see what you have to say about it.
So, you know, and if you're trying to be a professional writer I'm teaching a class called Literary Querying at the university.
Right.
And I've taught it a couple times. It's a very popular class. And the first class is all about lowering expectations and getting crazy. Because in order to try to make a living as an author or any kind of artist, you know you're up against it. So you have to take your I mean, go in knowing you're doing it for other reasons than monetary. And in America, anything that's not monetized is degraded, which is a travesty, in my opinion.
It's silliness.
Yeah, but if you can take your rewards in other ways and the people you meet, mm-hmm. which I have totally, my group of friends and my group of creative friends, compared to where it was 8 years ago, is black and white difference. It is night and day. I have got the most creative, interesting, struggling friends, and they are so much more interesting than the people I used to hang out with, which, well, don't get me wrong, guys, you're fine, but it's a broader area.
Polarizing.
The idea of giving back, right? You've got to measure yourself differently. You've got to measure your successes differently. And with that in mind, then you just give yourself a good kick in the head and you forget the odds, because if you think about the odds, you'd never start, because you write for something else. I kind of started writing for therapy. I wrote because you need to. I mean, a great piece of advice I give you is if you want to write, don't give it up. Put down the pen. Stop writing. Don't do this. Do anything else. Seriously, don't write. Don't go. Don't be an author. Don't even try.
Yeah, and see how long that lasts.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. and if you can't,
yeah,
if you exactly. can't stop, then maybe you're a writer. Mm-hmm. Because this is to make a living in this, and which way, manner, or form, is just the height of impossibility. But nevertheless, it's still possible. And you just got to go through it. If we're not dreamers, we shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah.
Well, you've done all right. Everyone has different levels of success. Granted, I would like to be on late night shows, and I would like Stephen Colbert to talk to me on primetime. But until that happens, I just...
You got the Calliope podcast.
This is part of it, and it's giving back. I don't know. Hopefully the writers who listen to this will come away with something useful.
Well, the thing is about, you know, like we've identified that you want to write for praise, mm-hmm. like which would be like awards, you know, have it be critically acclaimed, write for
profit
for money, or write for
personal.
And I have identified another one, mm-hmm. write to provide. You know,
yeah.
Right to give to others, right to forward a cause, right to enlighten, whatever it is. But
I'll
when you,
a
I, yeah, I had, better start with a P.
Keep
go
going,
ahead.
Keep on.
No, go ahead.
Posterity.
Posterity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I honestly.
We got a star.
Yeah. I honestly, if you ask me, to be honest, one of the reasons I write is to scratch on the wall mm-hmm. that people will remember me beyond my death.
That's great.
Isn't that stupid? I'm trying to make some kind of impact.
Oh, that's a human. That's a human being, you know? Yeah. Remember the time capsules?
Yeah, there it is.
There it is.
I mean, when I get a new book published, I immediately collect a bunch of copies, one for everybody in my family, and like five for grandkids I don't mm-hmm. have yet. Mm-hmm. This is all I can offer them.
I bought 300 books because I was going to pass them down. These are like for you guys to pass down. But you know, it's what's interesting about that is I wrote to make a difference, or I write to make a difference, mm-hmm. right? And for posterity. So it's very interesting that when accolades come, I kind of shy away, like I don't even want to say it. And then, you know, I've been on all the shows, and that was like the most nerve-wracking thing for me, right? So like those, whatever you want to call them, you know, pat on the back.
Well, it's
good job on the top of the head. Like those don't even, like, I don't, those aren't measurements of success for me.
Well, I think they're dangerous too. I really hate the rejection in this business. Like I said, I don't write well with others because I don't like their opinions.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're right, I admit it, and it takes me a while to figure it out. My first editing, I was editing Beatrice, I learned so much from Kate, and God bless you, Kate Jones, for sticking with me on that. I learned so much about the editing process, and now I'm an editor on the other side. I give rejection letters mm-hmm, now, mm-hmm. It's a whole different world, and it's tough.
Yeah, you got to do our course, Johnny. Because we that's what we do on day one.
What, we get rejected? I got that handled.
We separate your experience of failure rejection from the work. So, yeah, it's all brain science. We do brain science day one. So that we take that hook.
Experience, out
of it.
Well, I don't know. Well,
totally.
When I write, I don't think that way. But there's a part in the career when you get reviews.
When others see it, that's when it happens. Or when you have the idea, the thought, oh my gosh, a beta reader's going to look at this. So we separate that out. We go to work on the brain science so that you, you can dismantle that.
Well, you just pull it into a little cocoon on that. But when you start sending your work out to be placed, It's why Terry. It's why I have Terry. She's the buffer.
She's great.
She is the buffer between me and this rejection, because I've had a lot of rejections. I mean, for each book I placed all my books, and for each one I placed, I probably received 200 or 300 rejections. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of stupidity you have to have to continue with this. And every one of them hurts. And then sometimes you get really far, far along. I had Squirrel on a desk at St. Martin's Press, and that one hurt. That one put me in a tailspin for about a month. Oh, yeah,
sure.
Mm-hmm. And that level of rejection. See why I don't read Amazon reviews. I got a lot of great reviews.
Sure. I'm saying, because I'm having empathy for you, because I agree with you.
Yeah, yeah, that sucked, John. Yeah, damn right they passed on that. Terry showed me that. It sucks. No, it's but the same way. But the thing is the rejection's one part, and that I've put that suit of armor that we were talking about with that character or whatever you have to do psychologically to protect you from that. But don't think that praise is any different, because praise gives you that whole I'm a fraud feeling. Anytime somebody praises my work,
Imposter complex.
Yeah, the imposter complex. Exactly.
There's a word for it. It's fraud complex is what we've decided it's called.
And it's hard to overcome. I mean, I get in front of people and try to tell them what I've learned. And all I can honestly say is I've learned it the hard way, and this has worked for me. It may not work. You know, this is the problem I have with like anybody who's a gatekeeper of literature and art. Who the hell are you? Who do you think you are? You know, is what gives you the right to decide what's good and what's bad? See, I have a hard time editing some people's
work. That's not what they're doing.
It is.
They're determining what's marketable and what's
not. Okay. All right. There it is.
Yeah. I mean, they're in it for the intellectual property. Whether they like it personally is irrelevant. It is, can they sell it?
All right. See, that knowing that sure helps.
Okay. But they're not just like all evil geniuses, you know, back there trying to make money.
Oh, no.
You know, they're in publishing because they love. Oh,
my God. Unless you're looking at my book, then you're a lovely human being. Are those new shoes? They look great. You're right. It's a business.
It's a business. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the minute that, you know, the Game of Thrones model comes into play and we're like, oh, wow, that works.
Something different,
right? Now we've opened up that whole new world. And it's like, oh, it's like Game of Thrones. Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. We know we can sell it because Game of Thrones is huge, right? So that's exactly what has to happen first, is somebody has to crack that door open. And then, you know, you get a few that kind of come in there like that. And then, you know, it's like vampires, right? Then the flood of vampires comes and we don't want to see any vampires anymore. Right. So it's an interesting little model. And
yeah, I don't think it's exactly like, what's it called? Demand and something.
Supply and demand.
Supply and demand. It's not exactly not supply. Even. And demand. It's the gatekeepers got sick of, you know, they get sick of certain things.
Yeah, I guess. If you think back of every great book you've read, everything that we're taught in school as a classic, as great piece of literature, all of them break every rule that I'm supposed to follow to get published. Oh, three act structure. Tell me how To Kill a Mockingbird fits in that. Okay. I mean, I'll tell my classes, look at Dune, Frank Herbert's Dune. If you haven't read Frank Herbert's Dune, you're probably not a science fiction fan. Read it anyway. The first book, at least. It falls apart by book 78.
Yeah.
But the first book is fantastic. But you know who published that book? Do you know who published that book, Frank Herbert's book?
I don't.
Chilton,
yeah.
If you don't know who Chilton Publishers are, that's because you've never worked on your own vehicle. They publish car repair manuals. That's what they do.
Interesting.
If you want to figure out how to reassemble the carburetor on your 52 Mustang, actually be a 72 Mustang.
I've owned several Chilton manuals.
Yeah. So was he somebody's cousin or something?
And that's who finally saw Frank Herbert's options. A Hunt for Red October couldn't get it published. He got the Navy published that.
Really?
Did that just because something to do. So you never know. And it's just difficult. And then that's why I have a hard time editing other people's work sometimes, you know.
So as a university professor, what do you teach these budding young minds? Where do you go with this then? Oh. I mean, if you're against all of the structure and you're all about just kind of free for all, I mean, how do you educate?
Good question. Well, luckily I'm teaching people who want to be there. So I don't do grades. I'm lifelong learning. So it's people who really want to learn something useful. So I have to give them the money's worth. I have to give them something useful. I can't just give them a grade and have them forget about it. But it depends what I'm teaching. Mostly I do talk about structures and I talk about plotting and planning. And I talk about the thematic lighthouse a lot. Mm-hmm. Again, the outline's wonderful, but when you're navigating, I always think of an outline as a series of stops. Say you want to go from New York to Los Angeles. You will go on the way. You might, you have a beginning, you have an ending. You know, so far you've got 2 points. You've got 2 points in your outline. Along the way, you'll stop in Chicago, St. Louis. You'll stop in Houston. You want to go, you'll head up to Portland, Oregon for no good reason.
Yeah.
Whatever. And you put these different places. And it's, but all these are basic, then become lines on your outline scenes, right? And that's what I teach them. But as you go, now imagine these instead of cities, these are islands and you're on the ocean and you can go anywhere in the ocean. So you will now go to this island and that island and this island. How do you navigate this without getting lost? And you do that because you have a lighthouse. And off in the distance, I teach, you set up your lighthouse early on. And this is the question you are looking to answer, the problem you are working through.
Right, right.
Approach your book as therapy or at least as something, some kind of an idea. Of hero's journey, transition. I mean, usually you'll find this mostly in the character arc versus the story arc, your main thematic thing. And he said, you will use that as a lighthouse. And if you're ever lost, if you're ever stuck, you'll look at your lighthouse and say, ah, that's right. I'm talking about promises. Does this speak to that? If it does, okay. If it doesn't, steer it that way. And it now has a place in the book and it furthers that part of it. Because if you get stuck in your story or your character arc, you still have your thematic arc. So it gives them a third one. So that's the other thing to do with it. With in mysteries, which I teach a lot as well, I break down the different aspects of it, and I love that because it's an armature, and you can hang anything you wanted. It's you have a basic idea of a quest within a mystery, and the ideas mysteries are wonderful, and they're my favorite genre. It's because mystery is a story about a story. You've got something that happened, and the quest is to find out what happened.
Yeah.
So you have a story to find out the underlying
like
story.
Like a dream within a dream.
Yes. And then what is between you and there are other stories. Suspects with their own stories. Suspects and secrets and helpers. And it weaves a magical thing. And while you're putting this quest together as the hero's journey, you can explore anything, absolutely anything else. Some of the best, we have
pod racing, for example.
Take, for example, Harry Potter. Harry Potter, the original Harry Potter, is a mystery. It is a story about a story. The first story, the underlying story that the book is really trying to investigate is what happened to Harry's parents and the whole Voldemort, right? And so it starts out with an inciting incident, which is the repercussions of the previous crime. And as Harry goes through his adventure and learns to grow up and learns about the magical wizarding world, he is, in fact, playing detective. Which culminates with him facing the villain in the final scene. That's a fantasy. No, but you can break it down. You can put it together as major points of a mystery, and it drives it because it's a quest. Even though it takes him years and he's not really in a hurry to do it, he still uncovers a terrible plot. So that's kind of thing we're doing.
That's great.
The three-act structure, the hook is what I have problems with in my life.
Really?
The hook's a problem because I tend to have a slow start in most of my books. I try to have something grabby, but then I like the first act. I do. Setting a lot of the, Eleanor, for example, starts out with an interesting inciting incident, but it happens so quickly and it's so divergent from the rest of the book.
Well, a hook isn't like, how it's defined necessarily in the writing world. A hook is a promise. It's a beautiful promise.
It's a beautiful promise.
You don't
read a lot of horror, do you?
Well, horror can be written beautifully, too. Gorgeous promise, even if it's just two words. It's compelling, I should say. Compelling promise.
That.
Yeah. Because if you're looking from, I got to reel them in, I got to hook them, what does that do with the context for the writing? But you're promising for, what's to come, what to expect.
I can see that.
Yeah.
But I guess the issue I'm having here is the speed, having to propel everything very quickly now.
That it's all going to get out.
Yeah.
Just going to weave the backstory in later. I get that.
Yeah.
I always have to just trash the first couple of chapters.
Yeah, I see that. But with Eleanor, there's no three-act structure in there. I was approached by a movie producer. We were having a conversation. I was going to pitch Eleanor. Say, hey, this will make a great movie because I think it will. And I said, okay, so who's the antagonist? That stopped me. I had no antagonist.
Satan.
it's a character study. It's not that kind of story, which means if it's going to be made, it'll probably be an independent story because it's not black and it's not three-act structure. It's not antagonist versus protagonist. It is a character study of a girl going through some important emotional milestones. So Eleanor, I couldn't really pitch it that way, and that's okay. But the book still has It has a wonderful following, and I love this book very much. It's a love letter to my mother. And I think the reason why, when you get to the moments that really matter, that they impact my readers and me, I can't read the book anymore. I can't read the book without crying myself. That's what I'm pointing to. And the reason it matters, and the reason it affects the people this way, is because I did take my time.
Well, and you know, you got to know your audience. Right. Yeah. And I still believe that there is an audience out there for literary work.
I think so. They keep selling. And I think, and I honestly, I mean, the thing is about like young adult. I'm teaching a class on young adult in the summer. And the main difference between young adult and adult is young adults tend to be better read. That's silly to say. Young adults who read are readers, and darn it, they're good.
Well, the middle graders are reading YA. The YA readers
are reading adult.
Adult and adult. Precisely. And then the adults are reading
what their kids are reading.
Picture books.
I think adults are reading more young adult than young adults.
Yeah, yeah.
But, so going back to your editor, that was with our live courses, we do that panel session. And the panel session that we accidentally had you and your editor on the same panel.
Oh, we didn't even know. Yeah, we didn't
realize it. And that ended up being one of the most
interesting
things. It was incredible.
Yeah, I've had problems with my editors because, again, I blame myself. I was TJ, and he helped me with Celeste and David. And he and I...
TJ DeRosa,
TJ DeRosa, Jollyfish Press Managing Editor now. Great guy. We really worked together well at the end. But it was snippet because, you know, it's your baby. And as much as, you know, I write for myself, putting it out to other people is tricky. But TJ and I, we had a very lucky with Celeste. We had such a short amount of time that I could not do his fixes. I just flat out didn't have time. I remember meeting with him at a conference and said, okay, well, we have to get this out within a week, 2 weeks. Here's what I recommend. I said, ain't happening. I said, okay, well, we'll just go with it then.
Sneaky, right?
I know. I was so happy to do that. And then when David came out, I think he was more akin to, he knew at this point, I didn't have to prove anything. And this is what the advantage of being a published author is, by the way. It's the trust. And this is what the hook, back to the hook idea, is a hook. If you don't know the author and you don't know the book, you don't know what you're getting into, you want to grab them and hold their interest because you're afraid of losing them. In a longer series, or even, but there comes a point when the author trusts you. And usually that happens, I don't know, 100 pages into it. You can have a slower chapter to break the pacing down. You can get your backstory in then, right?
Mm-hmm.
Same thing happens as for a series. You love the first book. You'll give me some time in the second one.
Right,
to set it
exactly.
Up.
Mm-hmm. To expand.
And same with an author. I love this author. I don't know what they're doing here, but I'm gonna give them the benefit of the doubt. Mm-hmm. So by the time we got to the third book of David, TJ and TJ recognized, and I recognized that I had the audience by this point. They're going to read this, and this is an important part. We changed a few things up because it's a much different thing. In the third book of Eleanor's the first act of the third book. First half of the book doesn't even take place in Jamesford with all of her friends. It's a completely different story. It's a very personal story about Eleanor's background, which doesn't play into the main thing. But it is, many people say it's the best part of the whole series because by that point they're hungry for this, right? So that's part of it. So that's why I want to get more powerful in my writing where I have my fan base, where I can write any piece of shit and they'll read it, you know, but I'm not there yet. Let's face it. I mean, what's that new book? It's the title said James Patterson. I don't know what else it said, but that's all you need, you know?
Yeah.
New book. What's it called? James Patterson. Same as his last sex. That's all you need to see on the cover and it'll sell. That's my goal. And that's why when I get a new book published, I always measure my name against the title. And when they're reversed,
well, that is the measurement.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what they actually look at.
So one of my favorite Johnny Worthen quotes is that it's never been easier to get published. It's never been harder to be read.
So true.
Yeah, it's that goes right along with that.
Yeah, it's with the advent of technology, and that's really what it comes down to. The traditional gatekeepers of agents and editors and publishing houses are basically being sidelined by the primary forces of Amazon, among other people. What used to keep authors and publishers away was the technological necessity of creating paper books.
Mm-hmm.
That's gone now. Now, you can self-pub an ebook in 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You can get print on demand through places like Amazon, half an hour.
Yeah.
And
well, we advocate for traditional.
Yeah, I do too. Because the thing is the problem we have with self-publishing, and this has always been, before with self-publishing, it was called what was it called?
Vanity Press.
Vanity Press.
Yeah, I'm printed with Vanity Press. And the
vanity,
question,
as in vain.
As in vain.
As in maybe you shouldn't do that.
Exactly. And that's the problem, is you get some noise. There's so much noise out there.
Yeah.
Is that you get a curated product if you go through an agent or an editor or a publishing house. It's curated.
Yeah.
Somebody has found enough merit in this to put some time into it. So it comes with at least one positive review, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And and that's why it's never been harder to be
read.
Well,
and the marketing, and, you know, there's so much. And the packaging, you know, they still have their thumb on that.
So, Johnny, you're frequently featured as a speaker at conferences and around. What's coming up for you? What's next? Where can we find out more? And where we can see Johnny Worthen, the great? Is it all on your website?
It is on my website, which is www.johnnyworthen.com.
Okay, and we'll include that in the show notes.
Please do. Coming up,
what are you excited about?
Well, I finally get into StokerCon. I've been fighting to get in there for a long
time. Very cool.
I'm teaching at a horror university, if I get enough people signing up. I'm talking about mistakes where my class is called Mistakes Were Made. It's a hands-on writing editing workshop. Two Fun. Hours of sitting into it. I'm also, I'm president-elect of the League of Utah Writers.
Congratulations.
We're excited.
Talk about giving back.
Talk about giving back. It is the oldest and biggest writing organization in the state, 82 years. I'm a writer.
It's 82 now.
82. All right. And we are awesome. And we have a spring conference coming up. That'll be in April. Two summer workshops, one's on editing, the other's on marketing, with our own Angie Fenimore will be there on that. And then we have our fall conference in October. Around all this, I'll be at Henderson Writers in Las Vegas. I'll be, like I say, on the Queen Mary for StokerCon. I'm trying to get back to Pikes Peak and the Colorado Writers. They're very nice down there. Pikes Peak and Rocky Mountain Fiction Writers. Great groups down there. Learn a lot from them. And I say yes to anything. And I have a book coming out. Oh, this is, I plug this. I've got a lot of excellent books. And I have a new book coming out in September from Omnium Gatherum. It's a tricky piece. It's called What Immortal Hand? And it is not for the squeamish. It is a horror. And it is a fundamentally horrific book insofar as it's not full of gore, but the concepts I'm going to introduce you to will bother you.
And when is that coming out?
September.
Cool. September, this fall. So excellent.
And I'll send that to you guys. You can put it out there. It's
called
What Immortal Hand. It is, the tagline is, Michael was called of God.
Oh.
Just not that God. And it's a contemporary piece about...
The keep you up kind.
Kind of keep you
night.
Up.
Good. Nice. I need
love
those.
This book. It's I went insane when I wrote it, so it'll be fun.
Yeah, cool. It wasn't a it was a short trip, so.
Yeah, I was there for a while.
Welcome back.
They have a bed made for me there. It's really good.
Yeah. Well, cool. So if you could leave us with one parting gift for our listeners, new budding authors.
Sorry. I just had to say that.
One piece of advice for all buddling authors out there would be to stay true. Write what you want to write. Write what you want to read. Do not chase the market, please.
Mm-hmm.
Try to write to an idea. Have an idea, a general idea. See if your story can't be bettered by having a central idea behind it. Because believe it or not, there's one down there anyway. You just might not recognize it. Is that you're somebody will pick up your book after you've written it and you think you've written this very nice little story about hobbits. And somebody says, you've written about the horrors of World War I, haven't you? And Tolkien will say, no. And you'll have to say, yes, you did, because it's there anyway. So try to recognize what it is you're actually working through. And it'll make your fiction a lot better and make critics just like me, just very excited. So keep writing, be an artist.
Excellent.
What else is there?
Excellent. Well, you definitely have lived up to your colorful introduction, and it's been an absolute joy to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Oh, you guys are always
Johnny.
Awesome.
We adore you.
For you guys, except for shovel your walks. I'm not doing that again.
Hey, we got people to do that.
Excellent. So. All right.
We got that covered. Excellent. We got that. We do need somebody to do our windows, though.
I'll see what I can do.
All right, cool. Well, thanks, Johnny.
Thank you, guys. Andy, Mike, you guys are awesome.
If you like the show, shoot us some stars. It's all about the stars, baby. And be sure to share the Calliope Writing Coach podcast with your writer friends. You can find more episodes at calliopepodcast.com. Thanks for listening. Hey, hey.